is To Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, covering science, policy, attitudes, media coverage, and all of the beliefs that go into our understanding of how our personal health and well-being is affected by the health of everything in our world, our water, air, earth, the state, having a stable ecology, having a stable economy, having a stable democracy, the health of our communities, the health of our own attitudes, and of course, the balance and stability of our habitat, planet Earth. So each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between all of those different things, talking to authors, experts, scientists, activists, doctors, filmmakers, thought leaders, all of whom cover a different angle of that story of all that interconnects to create the world that supports our health and our life. So this week on the show, I'm really excited to have a guest who I immediately wanted to bring onto the show when I heard the title of his book, and regular listeners will totally understand why this is. I think it's just such a brilliant title. The book is called I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. The author is James Hogan. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And actually, he's And Jim Hogan is one of Canada's most respected public relations advisors. He's also served as the chair of the Suzuki Foundation, which is a prominent environmental foundation. Under the auspices of Canadian environmentalist and thought leader David Suzuki. Also, in reading the book and looking into Jim's work, I found out that he is a co-founder of one of my favorite websites, DSmog Blog, and which was founded to expose misinformation campaigns polluting the public debate around climate change and the environment. And a previous guest on this show, just about a month or two back, is Steve Horn of DSmog Blog, who is regularly writing brilliant exposés and keeping us all so well informed about everything going on with the Dakota Pipeline and now with the current administration. This is an absolutely, it's actually literally one of my favorite sites. So I'm so happy to have you here as a guest today, and our topic is going to be the nature of dialogue and how dialogue has sort of turned divisive, hostile, ugly, and really precludes, in my view, or my concern is that it's going to preclude our getting a broad enough public on the same page and coming together to really protect the environment and climate from the terrible threats that are in the process of being enacted by the current administration. So I'm so glad to have with us someone who is a master, a student, and an explorer of the nature of public discourse. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Jim Hogan.
Well, thank you for having me.
So your book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, you know, is basically exploring the fact that as the media, you know, it's I think initially with citizen journalism, with, you know, a plethora of different websites, with everybody kind of, in a way, it's been a terrific thing because it's kind of like it's set participatory democracy up to have this kind of public dialogue engagement with myriad websites and television shows and sources of information, you know, where people may have been kind of passive, inert, not really following what's going on in public policy sectors, not really participating in government policy very much or helping set its course. Now we have people very engaged. That's kind of because of the kind of exponential growth of this participatory media landscape. And, you know, that's the upside, and I think it's terrific. But the downside is it's become more and more, it's almost, I sometimes feel it has become like the Tower of Babel, where it's, you know, everyone is speaking a different language. People are informed by different media outlets and therefore in different media silos. And, you know, not able to communicate with people in the other silos. And instead, there's a lot of frustration, rage, miscomprehension, confusion that has sprung up around all of this at a time when we really, you know, we need to do better in this regard. And that's what your book addresses. You know, what is your view of what's going on right now among the different, you know, groups of people or in the different media silos?
Yeah, it's that's a big question, and certainly that is the question that I raised when I interviewed all these interesting people for my book. And it was it came in the form of a question that David Suzuki asked me when I was asked onto the board of the Suzuki Foundation. And it was actually the first day that I was on the board, and it was in 2003. And he and I we just finished the first day of this particular board meeting in Montreal, and we were at a French bistro in Old Montreal, and I was down at the end of the table with him and Ray Anderson of Interface Carpets, you know, the sort of great sustainability American industrialist, mm-hmm. just an amazing yes. man. And mm-hmm. so we were sitting down the end of the table, and we were talking away, and I remember saying something to David like, too bad that the environment is a lefty issue. And he said, what's wrong with being a lefty? And I said, well, there's nothing wrong with being a lefty, but why should the environment be a lefty issue? Doesn't, you know, the air is, you know, clean air is clean air, and you would think that whether you're on the right or you're on the left, you want your kids to have, you know, clean drinking water and clean air, and you don't want them to have asthma because you're, you know, pumping, you know, pollutants into the air. And we all care about our health and the health of the environment around us, but it seems like we've taken these issues of the environment, and they now seem to be highly politicized. And so the conversation kind of went on, and he said, one thing that I wonder is why. It was almost like he was really unhappy about his ability to connect with people, which I found really astonishing, because he's kind of, I don't know if you've ever seen David Suzuki speak, but he's like Mr. Standing Ovation. You know, he's an mm-hmm. incredible public speaker. And so he's asking me why he's not connecting with people, and why are people not in the streets demanding change, you know, on climate change and various other kinds of environmental issues that are stalking us all. And I remember thinking, you know, I mumbled something about the state of politics, but I realized that I had no idea why people weren't more angry and demanding change, and why it was that, you know, the environment, I think at that time was, right now and even now, it's way, way down the list of concerns that people have in the world of public policy. And, mm-hmm. I mean, if you're in the environmental community, you wouldn't think that, but actually in the general public, mm-hmm. that is the case. And so why is that? Because it seems it's pretty important, clean air, clean water, stable, you know, climate and so on. And so it's stuck in the back of my mind, and it's oddly something that comes up at virtually every board meeting of the Suzuki Foundation that I'm at. Somewhere or another, we're talking about some kind of public communications challenge. And so one of the things that I became really interested in as I thought more and more about this is the role that propaganda plays in sort of polluting the public square. So mm-hmm. it became really clear to me really quickly that just like you can pollute the natural environment, you can pollute the public square. Mm-hmm. And if you start to look closely at what the nature of that pollution is, it is propaganda. But early on, I thought of it as misinformation. So mm-hmm. that the propaganda was basically deceit. You know, people lying about, and it certainly in many and most cases is that. But I think that is part of the is not the bigger part of the propaganda problem. As I wrote this book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, what I came to realize is that when advocates, for example, say advocates for the fossil fuel industry, come up with ideas like clean coal or narratives. Up here we had one where it was ethical oil. These people were trying to argue that oil from the tar sands is ethical.
Oh, my goodness.
That the idea isn't that they're not actually trying to persuade you that oil is ethical or that coal is clean, that there's something else going on where it's almost like the propaganda is an attempt to massage tribal meaning into science and into these environmental issues. So the climate becomes an issue that goes something like this. That is not something that people like us believe in. And if you do believe in this climate change problem, you can't be one of us. You must be one of them. When you take language and you take important issues and you turn them into things that one tribe doesn't believe and another does, you end up enlisting a whole series of very powerful psychological forces, like motivated reasoning and such, or what Dan Kahan out of Yale Law School calls cultural cognition. So this idea that so evidence comes along, contradicts the views of my community. I don't change the views that I have along with my community because there's such a social and economic often cost to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I change the evidence. So I change the evidence to reinforce the beliefs that I already have. So you see more and more of that, not just in environmental issues, but on a whole range of issues like gun control and so on, where the level of unyielding one-sidedness and unreasonableness is just shocking. And the reason for all of this is not that people who are engaged in propaganda who are trying to deceive people, but they're basically trying to tribalize the issues so that you create a kind of a gridlock so things don't go forward. Then, and part of the exercise, this propaganda exercise, is what you might call a war on reason. So the narrative is, so you see something like the propaganda phrase, the tagline of Fox News, fair and balanced. And what that does, if you think about it for a minute, if Fox News is fair and balanced, it basically means that nobody's fair and balanced. There's no such thing as fair and balanced. It's all just people's opinion, and everybody's just in it for themselves. Nobody is actually speaking objectively and in the for the public good. And so it's kind of a there are no facts. There's just opinions. We're all biased. And so you end up in this situation through the use of this type of use of propaganda, where more and more people turn away from thinking that they can actually make a difference. And so you end up with this sort of these very, very high levels of polarization and mistrust, and just basically the belief that we're unable to solve our collective problems. And what that ends up doing, oddly, is it actually also drives people back into their tribes. And so they move from the public square, where they don't trust anything that anybody's saying, to smaller groups where they do know people and they trust them more. And so you tribalize it even more. And so this general kind of erosion of what you might call a public capital, sort of public trust, that when that is undermined, then people, it's basically all out a war, you know, so it's like a culture war. And evidence, it doesn't matter if you lie, it doesn't matter, facts don't matter. It's whose facts. Okay, I know the guys. I know that Donald Trump is lying, but he's lying for me. And so it becomes not a sort of it's anti-democratic because it undermines the whole process of public discourse, because when facts don't matter, there is no public discourse. And so you end up in this state where of just fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically.
Well, to me, that's important. I can hear what you're saying in terms of, the role of propaganda, and the way you trace that makes complete sense. At the same time, structurally, and this is something, and again, this is coming more from a progressive perspective. Structurally, we have a situation where there has been a steady course of privatization of areas of public good, attempts to do that and to sort of reduce the areas of, from the constant sort of cuts and assaults on PBS, on the post office, on providing health care, whatever it is, we want to privatize it, prisons, and so it all becomes business, it all becomes investment, and in that context, even with the best, and the same is true of the media, the largest liberal media, and I'm a lifelong Democrat, that's my background. But the liberal media, which the Republicans have targeted, like the Republican and right-wing media, is all owned by different corporate entities with different agendas. And so and there is bias in all media, and it's kind of inherent and built in. For example, just to give an example, here in the States, we have MSNBC, which is perceived as, a liberal outlet. And yet I can tell you that, with the advertising, the advertisers that are gas companies, natural gas and all of this kind of thing, they're slow and late in the game to cover fossil fuel. And its role with climate change, and instead they kind of soft pedaled that, or covered it in a kind of a way that both, brought it to the fore, but also debunked it. The global trade agreements, which would put fracking pipelines all throughout the world, and therefore have and take down environmental regulations and allow polluters free rein. They never covered that either. So, I'm playing devil's advocate here a little bit, because when we participate in the right, and I, the right-left side of that, and obviously the Republicans, the right-wing media has very strong intentions, plans to confuse. There are, number of think tanks, that really are out there to disseminate false information on climate, and that's extremely egregious, and we're grateful and thankful to have Desmog Blog. But the problem is that because all media is profit, for profit, and it's owned, and that's the way it's set up. It's not set up as a public good, or it's not, given independence. And the same can be said of certain science. In my view, it wouldn't be true of climate science, but also a lot of science, for example, health science and in the pharmaceutical arena, is funded with a profit agenda. So, in that context, the erosion of trust, the propaganda that you describe, which I completely see that, is occurring within an overall structural dynamic where these institutions that are assumed to be neutral, balanced, and, working for the public good themselves have various, they're owned and they have agendas. So in that sense, this, this mounting distrust also has both, it's been targeted by this propaganda, and it has a structural cause as well that contributes.
Yes. I completely agree with that. And I see, for me, when I started to write my book, it became really clear to me that we have these, and one of the people I interviewed for my book was Peter Senge, who teaches at MIT, at Sloan School of Business at MIT. And he's a social systems guru. And, you know, he said that one of the problems that we have is that we've created these systems that we are not able to manage. The world is full of these economic and, you know, business and, you know, well, you mean the fossil fuel industry is a system, right? So we've created these systems that are beyond our ability to control. And so that's true. And I ended up trying to sort of narrow down some area where I thought I could add something, because the problem is so massive that you just end up kind of, you know, drowning in the ocean with nothing, with no one in sight, right? And so so to me, there's one thing that we know about human beings is that we understand the world through stories, and that I think a lot of the time that since I've been, you know, I was chair of the climate project, Al Gore's climate project in Canada for quite a while, and I watched that whole kind of narrative unfold, the whole climate change narrative, and I have to tell you, I think that the environmental community is guilty of not telling its story in a way that is easy for your average person to relate to. It just, you know, so many people come out of a conversation about climate change just terrified to death. And I think we know that, you know, and we've tried to adjust ourselves to try to, you know, add hopefulness and you know, part of the story that shows the path forward and so on. I think Al Gore's done an amazing job with some of his follow-up work after Inconvenient Truth. But that was a problem. And I think that the extremists on the right who want everything to kind of continue down the status quo route have actually been pretty good at developing these narratives that lead to people. Deborah Tannen put it this way. She said that if you have racket outside of your house, you'll open the window to take a look to see what's going on. But if there's racket every night, you tend to sort of batten down the hatches and try to ignore it. And so we have that kind of problem in society today that when people look at not just climate change, but any of these environmental problems and other social justice problems, where it just looks so kind of unsolvable and unreasonable, and, you know, people running around with their hair on fire, and and so people look at it and they just don't see solutions because the positions on each side look so extreme. But this is actually part of the construction of propaganda, and to basically drive a misunderstanding of issues by polarizing them so that when people look at the sort of story of the environment, it looks like that the environment and these concerns are a fight between environmentalists and the establishment, or environmentalists and, you know, the oil and gas industry. And so there's what you might call an advocacy trap in all of this, that it's we need advocates. If we don't have advocates, we don't have the voice for change. And in this world right now that we're seeing unfold, the truth will just be obliterated. So you need advocacy. But at the same time, advocacy polarizes, and if you drive the polarization too far, and it looks like you've become more interested in demolishing your opponents than you are in the issue that you originally started working on, you're going to lose people. And so somehow we have to basically gain control of the narrative so that when people look at it, they realize we're not just talking about climate. We're talking about their climate. We're not just talking about water. We're talking about their water, the air that their children are breathing. This is all, you know what I mean? So we need to figure out ways to kind of crawl back into a place in the public square where we can build trust. I think so many of us who've worked hard on these issues like climate change have this idea that people need more information, when in fact what we need is more trust. We need more confidence in the voices that we hear, in their fairness, in their in this, you know, when we look at them, stories, that it's actually our story. It's not a story for the other side. It's a story for us. And so I think, you know, the work of people like Marshall Gantz is incredibly important. The work that he's done on how to construct powerful public narratives that build hope and pull people together and drive change. These are really important. And I think so for so long, I know in my case, it was true when I started DeSmog Blog, I just thought that the job was to drag these people out into the sunlight and try to explain what they're, you know, what they're up to. Well, I'll tell you, after about 6 years of DeSmog Blog, I wrote a book called Climate Cover-Up. And I went out talking about it, and it was very popular. It was a bestseller in Canada. So it came out, it's a book that was very similar to Merchants of Doubt that Naomi Oreskes wrote, but it was a more kind of common person's version of that. But we had all the facts. It was good research based on 6 years of work at DeSmog Blog. I went out talking to people, and I realized what I was doing was, you know, it was essentially people would come to a talk and I'd look at them and they're very interested. And it was like I was saying, you thought things were bad before you came in here. Just wait till I finish telling you about what I've learned. You're going to be even more depressed about this. Well, that's important. I think it's important for people to know when they're being duped. But I think that we need to know. It's more important for us to know what we can do about problems than it is about, you know, diving deep, deep, deep into problems.
Let me ask you a question, because as you were talking, one thing kind of jumped up at me from an exchange or, you know, a thread that's on my Facebook page today, because there's always a lot of dialogue and exchange going on, you know, posting things and then people talk about it. You know, there was a congressman who... And I regret to say I don't remember which state he was from, but he was confronted at a town hall by his constituents who were concerned about the environment. And he said, you know, the best thing that could happen for the environment is for there to be more rich people, because rich people want clean air and they want clean water just like everyone else. And so, you know, then from that he would extrapolate that, you know, having Rex Tillerson, the, you know, former CEO or current CEO of Exxon as the Secretary of State, you know, would just be the best possible thing, because nobody would want a clean climate more than wealthy people. And so the more people, the more money they make in fossil fuels worsening the climate, the better off we'll all be, because they really want it. And, you know, so there was a whole bunch of exchanges about that. And then some people were saying, well, they'll be able to get the, you know, as water becomes scarce, they'll have water, they'll have air purifiers. And I was thinking of Josh Fox's film, Let Go and Love, you know, his recent climate film of the last year. And he goes to China, and you see what it's really like when you're in a completely air-polluted setting where people don't even want to go outside. And one could readily imagine people living in, you know, in bunkers, you know, with controlled air supply, if the earth were to become more and more and more polluted. And so, you know, obviously this isn't going to be an option for the average person, or it's not going to be an option for poor people, but among the very wealthy, they could, in effect, control their environment. And so we had a whole exchange about this on my thread. And the thing I realize is one of the things that I think that's really puzzling and confusing people is why these extremely wealthy people, you know, would prefer to pursue, like the fossil fuel industry executives, the very fact that they, you know, brazenly continue to prioritize their economic gain over, you know, climate stability and well-being sends a message that, you know, in certain people's eyes, it would send a message that, well, there's really no problem here because they don't, you know, they don't seem to care about it. You know, and when I actually kind of created this story of what the life and living situation of someone with infinite resources would be to, you know, kind of live in an extremely enclosed and secured and air-protected environment on an extremely polluted planet. And it was quite compelling for people. You know, I think that when I see people, you know, like the current leadership in the administration sort of strutting around in complete confidence as they seek to, you know, expand excavation and fossil fuel development, that in and of itself sends a stronger message, perhaps, than all of our stories about, you know, what this is going to lead to and how soon, you know, the projections tell us it might lead to something, you know, that's really palpable for, you know, even for the wealthy. There somehow is a sense that the wealthy are immune from it. And if they're immune, then if I want to identify with them and be successful and wealthy and follow their lead and think they're going to help give me a leg up, then by extension, I'm immune. And in fact, we all, in a sense, live as if we were immune. I mean, most people, it's either, you know, you're trying to live off the grid and you're recycling and you're going around on a bike, or, you know, I don't live that way. And, you know, most people don't live that way. So how this comes down and actually affects lives, I mean, I've seen it due to covering the fracking and pipeline afflicted communities. But most people don't actually have any picture of what we're talking about in terms of how it affects them, and instead what they see is, you know, happy billionaires who wouldn't, without a care in the world about this.
Right. Well, I mean, there's absolutely no question that capitalism is one of the most powerful narratives, certainly in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other narratives, right? And I mm-hmm. think, you know, I think one of the it was interesting. One of the guys in my book, his name is George Lakoff. He's a mm-hmm. You probably know of him, a linguist. he was on CNN yesterday, and he was talking mm-hmm. about how people, how progressives should be talking about Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he was trying to emphasize is that you don't want to be, you don't want your story, if you mm-hmm. want it to be hopeful and compelling to people, to just be a reaction to his story.
Mm-hmm.
So if he is saying that the media is crooked, for example,
mm-hmm.
that
yep.
you don't basically, if you're going to be effective in dealing with him, that you don't mm-hmm. repeat his frame. What
uh-huh.
you do is you have your own story to basically
mm-hmm.
explain the value that the media brings in a liberal democracy. And
mm-hmm.
then you go on to show how what he's saying is actually not true. But you don't basically repeat his message for him. And
right.
so I think a lot of the time, you know, if you sort of generalize that habit we all have, I mean, it's basically something we're taught when we go to university. That's how, you know, this comes from Descartes, right? I mean, so you're basically, you know, but the public square is not a place for necessarily for reasoned argument in the way that, say, a university classroom is. You know,
mm-hmm.
when you have very, very high levels of polarization and mistrust, the rules of engagement and communication are quite different. And I think it was interesting. One of the people I interviewed for my book was the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Dharamsala and I was talking to him about climate change because I had read that WikiLeaks had some information that about a conversation the Dalai Lama had with the ambassador from India. And
mm-hmm.
The Dalai Lama had said that he was more concerned about the impact of climate change on the Tibetan plateau than he was about the conflict between Tibet and Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was surprised. I said, did you say that? And he said, yes. And he explained that how politics will change, but these other changes where and these changes are happening in the headwaters of most of the great rivers of Tibet, of Asia, you know, the Salween, the Yangtze, the Brahmaputra, so many of the great rivers of Asia start on the Tibetan Plateau, and he's very worried. So I was, you know, I was kind of asking his advice about how, you know, how we could communicate better about climate change. And so one of the things he said, oddly, was after the whole interview was finished and we are standing up and they're turning off the cameras and he has to go to a talk. And he reaches over and he put his finger on my forehead and he said, you know, we like to think the Western mind is more sophisticated, but in Tibet, we go with the heart. And I think that might be stronger. You know, maybe if we take the Western mind and the Tibetan heart together, we can start to fix some of these big problems. And I remember feeling afterward, basically he was saying what we need is more warm-heartedness. And I think that there's something in that, that we do need to be able to cultivate our sense of empathy as advocates so that we can better understand the position that people are in. You know, it kind of goes to your question about people really finding the whole I can get rich too narrative as appealing. And basically try to have a deeper kind of emotional dialogue with people as opposed to just giving them science and facts and fury. Because I think it's that, you know, one of the best examples, I think, of a climate change narrative was the Pope's encyclical. I don't know if you had a chance to look at that, but it actually is a narrative that had quite an impact, not just on Catholics, but on the general public in the United States. It's one of the few things, few narratives that has actually moved public opinion on climate in the United States over the past couple of years. And it's basically, in my view, a powerful example of a moral public narrative that sort of moves people deeply by talking about the moral why of why we have to do something about climate change. And certainly the Pope is the Pope, and none of us are going to be able to be the Pope, but I think we can all learn from the, you know, how powerful a moral narrative can be by looking at the encyclical.
That makes a lot of sense. What do you think about in-person community dialogue as an antidote to sort of, you know, brickback throwing and slight impersonality and virtual quality of the internet? One of the things, I divide my time between New York City and a very small rural community. And one of the things that I've noticed is that, you know, in a large urban environment, there are enough people one can find and take action with who all agree. So, and one isn't really coming into contact with people of, you know, other views as much as in a, you know, rural community where everyone has to kind of live together and get along. And they may hold these views, but when you're in a smaller community setting, the sense is that almost as if we don't discuss religion and politics because, you know, then we're going to get into a fight and we're not going to get along. So I've also been experimenting and considering the role of in-person, trying to create some safety for in-person community get-togethers where people, you know, acknowledge that they have different views and hold them even in each other's presence in order to kind of just cultivate empathy and sort of downturn that constantly up-leveling increasing anxiety and fighting that's otherwise going on. One of the things also is that I personally am of the boomer generation, but I really feel for the millennial generation who are going to be inheriting this situation. And the two generations, there really is a kind of divide between them in terms of how briskly, you know, we think things can proceed versus how much time we think we have to solve these problems. So there the disagreement is not so much over whether climate is happening, but whether, you know, I'll be alive to see the ill effects of it, and therefore how pressed I might feel to make it a primary concern versus, for example, reacting to the bigotry shown in the campaign and you know, and in the new administration as a primary concern, which is, again, that's reactive in a sense. And, you know, there's also a sense that, you know, perhaps we're being played a bit. But how do we bridge that generational divide between well-intentioned people who actually agree on climate?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. And, you know, I think I've had some experience with dialogues, using dialogues to have discussions about community sustainability. Mm-hmm. So talking about a whole wide range of environmental and economic and social issues together in under an umbrella of sustainability. We did them across Canada, and it's very powerful. I think dialogue is we need a lot more dialogue. I mean, the problem is that you stir up questions, you know, but you also, I've seen light bulbs going off around dialogue tables, like genuine dialogue, where you're not, you know, disguising monologues as a dialogue, but where you're actually mm-hmm. going to a table where you're as willing to learn as you are to explain yourself, mm-hmm. which is not, that's rare, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think the kind of stuff that Van Jones does is very interesting. And I think dialogue mm-hmm. is kind of a, you know, it's that type of thing where you're actually really willing to listen to people. One of the things I've learned over the years as a PR person is that we have a sense, you know, people have a tendency to think of you know, someone who's a good communicator as someone who's mm-hmm. kind of charismatic and articulate and, you know, able to tell a good story and so on, and that's all true. But what's more true about what makes up a really good communicator is somebody who is either listens to you or has listened to you, and that you can see in what they say yourself. And I've seen over the years that a lot of miscommunication can be cleared up if people think that you're actually listening. That if you listen to them, they'll listen to you. And mm-hmm. that's just sort of a general principle. And that's basically the magic of dialogue.
What kind of ground rules when you have these you know, exchanges or dialogues do you set so that, you know, I mean, you don't want it to be suppressive, but you also want it to be somewhat safer. So, you know, is there a way you set ground rules, or how do you handle it if things were to flame out, if you haven't set ground rules? I think that would also be, you know, important to know because I basically, when we did these, we basically were listening, but, you know, somebody could have come into the room, it actually didn't happen, you know, and really flame out about something that didn't happen to happen. But it could happen. I mean, how do you prepare and set that up so that you know you can manage it, and then also the other participants feel like, you know, somewhat safe and there's some containment?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember it was a while back that we did them, but there was, we used the choice dialogues approach that mm-hmm. Was developed by Daniel Yankelevich. And mm-hmm. so his team basically they organized the dialogue model. So I can't remember everything that was on. What's that?
Mm-hmm.
He was a pollster. You know, he's older now, but he was a pollster. He was also an advisor to 6 or 7 presidents, and he owned one of the biggest polling companies in the United States. But he became disillusioned with polling and started to look at dialogue as a way of one of the things he says that it does is, rather than just give you a snapshot in time of what the public is thinking, a dialogue will show you how people will change their thinking once they're presented with certain kinds of information and they have to work through, you know, difficult trade-offs and so on. So a dialogue, if it's done well, as you know, and you're looking at it as a research tool, it'll actually show you where people are headed in the face of certain types of information and conversations. So in addition to being a kind of an effort to try and, you know, increase the amount of reasonableness around some kind of community dispute, it can also be a research tool. And so, but one of the things that I do remember, one of the ground rules was that it was the confidentiality. So a lot of that these meetings were, you could report back on things that were discussed, but not attribute them. So people felt like they could say whatever without being kind of quoted and, you know, ending up in the newspaper or something, right? And so it did open up the conversation that way. And then I think there was this to and fro of the conversation. A lot of it was structured so that you had different things happening at different times that allowed people to actually say their bit. And then I think one of the things they did was they actually developed what would you call them, sort of rules of engagement together. And so right at the very beginning, there was like this brainstorming where, you know, you basically said, okay, what will we all agree on that we think will help us have a healthier conversation? And so different people have their, and so you have like the list, and then you keep it up throughout the entire dialogue. And then you just refer to it and say, well, we early on we agreed so-and-so, no name-calling or whatever, right? It tends to be one of the things that I noticed, and I did this with, this may sound funny to you, but I did this with Shell. I had a woman who worked for me who, she'd been working for the government for a few years, and she ended up getting a senior position at Shell in Calgary. And she called me and said, asked me if I would represent them. And I said, you know, I don't think I can do that. At that time, I was chair of the Suzuki Foundation. And so I phoned David Suzuki, and I said, I got this weird phone call from Shell. And, you know, they're wondering if I would go meet with them to talk to them. And so he said, well, you might as well. Nothing else is working. So I went to Calgary. and I sat down in this meeting with all their senior people. And they had a guy there who was with National PR, which I think is owned by Burson Marsteller. And he was sitting across the table from me, and he was trying to explain to them how they needed to get their message out because people clearly didn't understand the oil sands, the tar sands. And I said, that's like totally ridiculous. You know, I mean, I knew I wasn't going to work for them. I said, look, if you think that the tar sands are a PR problem, then we have a bigger problem here than climate change. We have like so much confusion around this issue. This is ridiculous. This is not, the tar sands is not a communications problem. It's not a misunderstanding. You know, it's producing a product that's warming the climate. And so what I suggested to them was that I said, look, I'll set up dialogues with you for you with the environmental community in Canada and the UK. And so I set up dialogues in this happened over about 2 years, in Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, and London, England. And they went on over a couple of years. And at the end of the first series, I remember talking to, at the end of the first series of dialogues, it was, we ended up in Montreal, and the guy who was the most senior guy in the tar sands for Shell, he basically ran their whole tar sands operation, was sitting down across from me, having a drink after the dialogue, and he said, "This is going to change the way I go about doing what I do." And it wasn't that, like, you know, I'm sure people listening to this saying, yeah, well, what you want them to do is just stop working there. But but even that, it may not be, it may not take you to the goal line, but to basically, for this guy to go through the pro, and I was watching a lot of them around the table where light bulbs were going popping on, that you basically saw these people real and got, they're sitting across from very sophisticated environmental leaders, and they realize that they know what they're talking about, and that they're not kind of crazy. You know what I mean? So just even that opens up, you know, it builds enough trust. The kind of stuff that you don't see when you see, you know, you watch all these kinds of air wars that go on social media and traditional media. So they're basically getting to know these people. And I think it's, you know, I think it ended up in, there were some really great initiatives that came out of it. I think they didn't continue with it, which I was really disappointed in, because I thought, you know, it could actually really have driven some change. And I think, so I'm a huge fan of dialogue, but most of the time you won't get organizations to commit to it, because it really is a way to change things. Because ultimately, you know, if you go through a dialogue about climate change, you're going to come out the other end of that dialogue realizing how serious a problem it is. It's just going to, that's the way it's going to be. And so, you know, a lot of the time people don't want to go down that road.
Well, you know, I got into an exchange with someone of my Facebook friends who basically told me, and this is somebody coming from a right-wing perspective, she said that even, and, you know, we went back and forth and had an extensive exchange about this. She said that even using the phrase climate change registered to her and her right-wing family members as hateful, as hate directed toward them, because they were, you know, were so entrenched in the belief that this was a concocted thing that she couldn't envision a way that they could hear the phrase climate change. It was like a red flag in front of a bull, and it translated as hatred directed toward them. And, you know, we had quite an exchange about the fact that I wasn't feeling hatred toward her, and I wasn't intending or meaning hatred in using the phrase. You know, we went back and forth about that a great deal. But she actually said to me that the whole problem could and should be addressed by talking about pollution, because pollution is something that people can relate to and they don't want in their communities. And she thought that the entire I'm mentioning this because it's information coming from someone, you know, who views the matter, you know, in a different way than I do. You know, she was suggesting, in attempt to be constructive, that that phrase never be used because it had been rendered so toxic and was so alienating, you know, to people. And, yeah, so anyway, I'm just
I think that's really interesting. I mean, there's all sort. Dan Kahan is doing some really interesting work on climate change adaptation, I guess, you know, in Florida, with with basically various levels of Republican levels of government, state,
right,
and local.
Sure.
But But the ocean is rising, right?
Yep.
So you got to deal with the problem, right? And
that's
so
right.
As long as you don't require that they admit they're wrong before you start working with them. But there are a lot of people working on this kind of how do you talk to Republicans about climate change, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to this idea of how do you develop narratives that ease the polarization. So it seems to me that we need to ask ourselves when we're involved in advocacy whether or not we're actually increasing the polarization or are we diffusing it?
Mm-hmm.
And if we are increasing the polarization, do we have a good strategic reason for that?
Mm-hmm.
So that,
well, there's
you know
a whole other there's a whole other topic. You know, we're coming near to the end of our time here. This has been such a terrific conversation. I would actually love to invite you back to talk about strategy, because what you just said, are we being strategic? You know, I'm not sure on the left that we always know what being strategic is or what it would look like, you know, because
right.
There is a tendency to be in a reactive posture all the time. And it's not something I think we're very good at. So maybe you'll come back on the show and talk about strategy at some point, because I mean, I'd love that. It would be so helpful. I just want to say for our listeners that I'm talking to James Hogan, the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. We're talking about dialogue, the kind of up-leveling of divisiveness in the public forums of our time, the role of the media. Highly, highly recommend this brilliant book, and I hope that you can see from this conversation that Jim Hogan has a lot to offer to these considerations and this discussion of creating a unified and larger tent of people who are, you know, ready to act and act successfully even in the current environment. We're coming now down to the end of our show. I'm really happy that you have agreed to come back. You know, I just want to point listeners to the book. I think you'll really love it. Very important conversation. Thank you so much for all the work you've done and the exploration that you've done and the book on this really, I don't know, crucial turnkey for the time that we're in and the time ahead.
Well, thank you. It's really enjoyed the conversation.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us for another edition of Connect the Dots. Get the book, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, by James Hogan. And tune in next week at Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network for our next edition of Connect the Dots. Be well, chin up, and keep marching forward. I'm Allison Rose Levy.
Well, who, 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 well